Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We begin today's show by talking about the devastating wildfires ravaging the West Coast. At least 20 people have died from the fires in California, Washington, and Oregon. In Oregon, 500,000 people are under evacuation orders, and that state's population is just 4 million. Portland and the Bay Area currently have the worst air quality in the world. In Butte and Yuba counties, which are in Northern California, the North Complex fire is now the state's deadliest blaze of the year. 10 people have tragically died and 16 are missing. Joining us with the latest is Danny Anguiano. Danny is reporting from Paradise, California for The Guardian. On November 8th, 2018, Paradise, a community of 27,000 people, was swallowed by the ferocious Camp Fire. It razed virtually every home, killed at least 85 people, and displaced thousands. Danny Anguiano is co-author of Fire in Paradise, an American tragedy. Hi, Danny. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. I was just reading the piece that you and three of your colleagues wrote from Portland, Oakland, New York, and you're in Paradise. Can you just talk about how you all are, you know, putting a plan together to fire the to cover these fires, given that there are so many and they're moving so quickly?
Right. You know, it's a huge scope all over the West Coast. And so it really requires quite a few people and a good team to be able to figure out how we're going to get this information from this vast swath of land.
Well, thank you for what you're doing, because the piece that you all wrote is just full of so much information. I understand. So you're in Paradise now, Danny. We had you on a couple of months ago talking about your book about the horrific fire in November 2018. What is the latest with Paradise today?
So Paradise today is a town of maybe about 3,000 people. Most of the residents who were displaced there didn't return, largely because most of the homes there were destroyed. And so the people who are there now are really determined to rebuild and get Paradise back to what it was before. However, with this fire and with all the fires that have been burning all over the state for the last month, it's been really difficult. I think it's been really traumatic for a lot of people to see Paradise yet again just draped in smoke the same way it was that November day. And now, actually, this week, part of the town was under an evacuation warning because of this fire that has now killed at least 10 people.
Mm. And as you report, more than 16,000 people displaced by the Paradise fire have moved to other Butte County communities. And so many of these people are dealing with another evacuation. This has to be just so traumatizing.
Absolutely. I mean, to have this again so soon after this very difficult fire, and even before the Camp Fire, there were several fires in Butte County that you know, displaced quite a few people. So to just have this year after year is really difficult for people, especially for those who, you know, escaped the Camp Fire in Paradise, which was a really harrowing evacuation. You know, a lot of people found themselves on roads that were overrun with flames all around them. So to escape that and then be displaced again, you know, for instance, my own cousin who lost her home in Paradise, she just recently evacuated from her new home in Oroville, and it really takes a toll on people.
You actually wrote a story about this called Trauma, Fear, Homelessness, Life After California's Deadliest Fire Shows the Future of the Climate Crisis. And you interviewed just a number of people who've been displaced by these fires. What really stood out for you?
What stood out for me was really the scale of their struggles and how long it takes to try to recover after something like this. You know, one woman I interviewed, she had really struggled for a lot of her life and finally, you know, sort of got things together when she moved up near Paradise. And then the fire happened and she found herself homeless again. And, you know, she's lived in countless places just in 2 years. She slept in a tent. She has camped, you know, in burned forest. She has bounced from friend's couch to friend's couch. And it's so difficult to come back from something like this. I think our collective memory is kind of like, oh, well, that was 2 years ago, you know. Mm-hmm. And people I interview say, because they get asked all the time, you know, aren't you over it yet? But this is a life-altering event that takes a huge toll on people mentally, emotionally, and also financially. It's very difficult to come back from.
Right. Dani Anguiano is covering the fires up north. She's in Paradise, and she's going to be covering the massive fire now in Butte and Yuba counties. She'll be with us for about 10 more minutes. So if you have a question for Dani about covering these fires, yesterday we did a show, actually it was 2 days ago, about how the climate crisis is really exacerbating these fires and extreme weather. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Dani, just reading about what's going on in Butte and Yuba counties, these fires have now pretty much merged, and so there's a new name for them, the North Complex Fire. As of this morning at 8 o'clock, according to Cal Fire, it's only 23% contained, and we're just learning this morning that sadly 10 people have been killed and 16 people are missing. Can you give us the latest?
Right. So, yeah, as you said, we just learned that 10 people have been killed. Authorities are still looking for 16 people. And we know that one of the people who died was a 16-year-old boy named Josiah Williams, who lived in Berry Creek, which was a small rural community in Butte County that has essentially just been leveled by this fire. His mother confirmed that he died in the fire. The DNA has confirmed that. And we don't know exactly what happened. It appears, you know, he was trying to run away. This is a very, very fast-moving fire. And at the same time, while his family's dealing with this, you know, I spoke with his aunt. She just found out that her home burned down, and then a few hours later found out that her nephew had died.
Mm. So tragic. What explains, you know, why is this moving so fast? Is it because of the wind?
Yeah, so Butte County is kind of famous for fires. We have these canyons that get a lot of wind, and it's, you know, a perfect storm of conditions that can create these really fast-moving fires, and that's basically what we're seeing here. This was a fire that started a few weeks ago in the lightning storm that I think we all remember that was quite jarring, and then, you know, it carried on for a couple weeks, and then this week it just blew up, and overtook, you know, these communities and threatened the town of Orrville.
You report that more than 2,000 homes and other buildings have burned, but the final toll is expected to be much higher.
Right. Yeah, we just don't know how much damage there is, you know, in terms of property and how many lives are lost. And unfortunately, you know, judging by the number of missing, it looks like that death toll could grow.
Mm. Well, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Ron near Fairfield. Hi, Ron. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm actually in Hamilton Field. But the bottom line is I have a question. I've been involved in student service projects for over 30 years and focusing on fires, as we related 30 years ago with bioaccumulation from dioxins. With all the soot, with all the fire-related substances in our air, on the grounds, on buildings, why is there not a mandate about going back to school until the fires are gone so that we don't bioaccumulate these toxins, which eventually can lead to cancers and other diseases? It's ridiculous to allow anything to take place where a student can travel, go into a building that's yet completely sanitized, which the exterior can't be yet, and they need to wash away all this particulate that's landed everywhere. And we don't need it landed in our lungs to eventually manifest in some disease. Please, let's stop the going back to school until these fires have been contained. Smoke stopped.
Well,
can't even walk outside.
No, it's so difficult. I went outside for 5 minutes and it was just awful yesterday. What is it like? We'll take the question in a minute, but what is it like where you are, Dani, in Paradise?
I mean, it's been really, really smoky. Ash falling everywhere. It hasn't been that different from, I think, what we're seeing in the Bay Area, just even stronger, even worse, basically.
Well, and to Ron's point, The air quality in the Bay Area and Portland is some of the worst air in the world. And we did a show recently about what we now know about the health effects and how smoke, wildfire smoke, affects our immune system, our overall health. According to Stanford, wildfire smoke is worse for kids' health than smoke from controlled burns because there's so many toxic chemicals in wildfire smoke. Have you reported on this, Danny?
You know, a bit. We talked about this in our book. You know, with controlled burns, you're talking about burning, you know, vegetation and brush. With a wildfire, you know, particularly one that has destroyed all these buildings, when those buildings burn, they can release all kinds of toxins, you know, asbestos, all sorts of things that are really hazardous to us.
Well, thank you for the call, Ron. We will definitely do another show about air quality. And if you'd like to check out the show we did a few weeks ago, you can just search for it. It starts at about 30. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. Danny, what are you hearing from CAL FIRE at this point? Because when we did our show about the climate crisis, you know, we're just learning that CAL FIRE does not have enough people to deal with this. They don't have enough equipment to deal with this. What are you hearing?
Right. I mean, resources continue to be spread thin. This has been a really challenging fire season for CAL FIRE with, you know, with the sheer number of blazes. And then also, you know, with the COVID outbreaks in prisons that I think has made it harder, you know, to get the inmate firefighters that they rely on to battle these blazes.
I mean, it's just incredible to look at the map. It's just bright red from California all the way up to Washington State.
Right, that's exactly right. It's really jarring. And even for me, you know, I've been reporting on, I've been covering fires in California for a long time, but it is shocking to me that almost 2 years ago, you know, I was in Paradise covering the worst fire the state has ever seen. And the point that we make in our book, Fire in Paradise, is that will happen again, that towns will get destroyed again, but I never expected to be back here so soon.
Wow. We have a question from Pranay who says, what support do people displaced by fires receive from the government and other sources? They must be giving all the assistance, financial and otherwise, they need to get back on their feet.
Yeah. We certainly hope so. I know that isn't always the case. It can be quite difficult for people to get the support they need. You know, a lot of people don't have you know, for people who don't have homeowners insurance, for instance, that makes it harder. And so getting support through the state and through FEMA, for instance, when a disaster is declared, can be quite time-consuming and difficult for people. But that's basically the route that they try to take, that and community, you know, support and donations. Whenever we see one of these big disasters, a lot of donations pour in. But one thing to note on that point is if you do want to support fire survivors, the thing to do is not to send a bunch of supplies, because that can actually really overwhelm communities. It's to make monetary donations and send gift cards and that sort of thing. And that's ultimately, you know, what will be helpful and how you can support fire survivors.
Well, thank you for that question, Pranay. And that's another show that we'll need to do in the coming weeks. Greg has a question. Do you know where we can go to find a map showing the up-to-date current boundaries of all the fires?
If you go through the CAL FIRE website, they have the various incidents around the state linked, and those maps should be pretty up-to-date. If you're concerned about a fire in your area in particular, I recommend going through, you know, your local CAL FIRE branch or your local police or sheriff's office, because they're also pretty good about providing links to that sort of thing. And they can also provide up-to-date links in the event that, you know, sometimes these maps get overwhelmed and it's difficult to get them to load.
All right. And that website is fire.ca.gov, fire.ca.gov. Before we let you go, Danny, The Guardian has a whole section on the climate crisis. So you are all doing amazing work. I mean, you've been doing amazing work. But there have been, you know, a lot of people are putting out complaints and reports from Media Matters, for example, saying that the media overall need to do a better job of making the connections. Of course, there are still a lot of unanswered questions around this, but we know for sure that the climate crisis exacerbates wildfires and extreme heat.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, the conditions that we're living in, this hotter, drier California caused by the climate crisis, that is certainly making for worse, more destructive wildfires. And that's one of the things that I think is so frustrating to see, is that, you know, we have made these decisions over time, and people like Josiah Williams are suffering the consequences. So there absolutely is a connection, and, you know, media, we should be doing all we can to illustrate that in every piece we do, that this is, you know, climate crisis disaster.
Well, Danny, stay safe up there. Thank you so much for your reporting, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Danny Anguiano is reporting from Paradise, California for The Guardian. Danny is co-author of the book Fire in Paradise, An American Tragedy. You can find her reporting. She and a number of her colleagues are teaming up to bring us the latest from California to Oregon to Washington State. And we will definitely continue to cover this issue because it's moving so, so quickly. Well, now we are going to switch gears and talk about the possible impacts of voter suppression on the election. It is just right around the corner. It is 52 days away, 52 days away. We're joined now by Ari Berman, senior reporter at Mother Jones and author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Hi, Ari. Thanks so much for joining us. It's been a while.
Hey, Rose. Thank you for having me back. And hopefully you guys are doing okay with all the wildfires and craziness. Oh,
yeah, thank you. You know, we're hanging in there and doing our best. You know, Ari, there's so much going on with voting. 52 days away, you cover this nonstop. At this point, what really concerns you the most?
Pretty much everything, to be honest with you, Rose. I mean, the fact that we already had a number of really important states take steps to make it harder to vote before the pandemic hit. And then the fact that the pandemic has just scrambled everything when it comes to running smooth elections. States are going to vote by mail in much higher numbers than they expected. And so the question is, can states handle that? At the same time, the question is, can states run elections the traditional way, which is in-person voting? Will there be enough polling places? Will there be enough poll workers? So there's so much more uncertainty around this election than any previous election that I've covered. And it's so much more difficult to run a smooth election in a pandemic than it would be otherwise, not to mention there are already forces out there that are trying to make it more difficult to vote, and they can weaponize the pandemic to suit their interests.
Right. Okay, so let's go over all of these. Tell us about the states that took action just recently to suppress the vote.
Well, there's been a lot of problems in the primaries. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with this. But you take Wisconsin, for example, which had their primary in April, when they closed a massive number of polling places. In Milwaukee, there were 180 polling places. There were five polling places instead of the usual 180. You take Georgia, for example, where people were standing in line at 12:30 at night to vote in majority black precincts, 5-6 hours after the polls were supposed to have closed. Even in states that didn't have outright voter suppression, there were big problems with mail ballots. In Pennsylvania, for example, tens of thousands of mail ballots weren't counted because they didn't arrive in time, or people didn't sign them correctly, or they had a quote-unquote mismatched signature. And so if you look at the primaries in general, over 500,000 ballots were thrown out in the primaries. 500,000 mail ballots were thrown out, which is a big increase over 2016. And the fear is that that number is going to rise dramatically in November, when a lot of people who didn't vote in the primaries vote for the first time. And unless they're familiar with voting rules, they could be very confused about how to vote in a pandemic and might not be able to vote or might not have their votes counted.
So let's talk more about this, because this is huge. 550,000 absentee ballots rejected in the primaries, far outpacing 2016. First off, can you tell us why these ballots are rejected? The signature is a big part of it. Can you talk about that first?
Yeah, they're rejected for a few different reasons. One reason is because people forget to sign their ballots. Or they might sign them in a way that the signature on their ballot doesn't match their signature when they registered to vote. So election officials can throw out these ballots for quote unquote mismatched signatures. Another very common reason why ballots are thrown out is because they don't arrive in time. In many states, your ballot has to arrive by election day. And so if you mail your ballot and there, for example, are delays because of the post office, this is why the post office was such a big issue and it remains such a big issue, that your ballot might not be counted for that reason. And so those seem to be the most common reasons why ballots are thrown out. And there's a lot of concern that people don't always understand the rules of mail voting, because up until recently, only a few states held all mail or close to all mail elections. But at the same time, there's huge concern over major mail delays because of what's happening at the post office, that people can make a good faith effort to send their ballot back in time, but it won't be counted because of post office delays or because election officials are overwhelmed and don't send back the ballots in time.
Right. I heard the post office say, think of this election around October 20th, not in early November, because it's going to take about 2 weeks to get your ballot from your home to the election office. And if you can, drop it off in person or put it in one of these election boxes. That might even be a better bet.
Exactly. And irrespective of all the things that are going on at the post office, that is good advice. That basically, because of delays at the post office, which are very, very unfortunate, but are unlikely to really be improved that much before the election, it's just taking a long time to get ballots sent back. Also, election officials are overwhelmed and often aren't sending out ballots as quick as they'd like because there's so many ballots for them to process. So what the post office and election officials are telling voters is make sure you request your mail ballot at least 2 weeks before the election and make sure you send it back at least a week before. In some states, like in California, your ballot only has to be postmarked by election day. It can arrive later, but in a lot of key swing states like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Michigan, your ballot actually has to arrive by election day. So if you mail it, you need to factor in the time it might take for that ballot to arrive, or better yet, in a lot of states, you can drop your ballot off. And I would urge people to do that instead, because then you're putting less stress on the post office and less stress on election officials.
Ari, this information is so important to get out. What are your thoughts, before we go to break, about how the media are doing right now to give people this information?
I think the media are trying, but the problem the media has is that Trump is spreading so much disinformation about voting. He's lying so often about voting that the media is spending a lot of time fact-checking Donald Trump instead of giving people the real information they need to know about voting. So to the extent possible, I am just trying to ignore what the president is saying and focus on the real problems that are going on and try to get people as much information as possible to understand that voter suppression is real. It is something that we have to overcome. But if people are proactive and they make a plan to vote early, whether they vote early in person or whether they vote early through the mail, you're able to counteract a lot of this suppression.
Right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk more about why 550,000 absentee ballots were rejected in 2020, far outpacing the 330,000 that were rejected. I'm sorry, 318,000 that were rejected in 2016. We'll find out what else you need to know to ensure that your ballot is counted. And we'll give you other information you can use to share with friends who might live in battleground states. Today, we are joined by Ari Berman, a reporter with Mother Jones and author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are speaking with Ari Berman, senior reporter with Mother Jones and author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, about the upcoming election. If you have any questions for Ari, he is reporting nonstop on this issue. You can give him a call or give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. You know, Ari, just thinking about these numbers here, that 550,000 ballots were rejected in the primaries, Trump won Wisconsin by just 23,000 votes, And more than 23,000 absentees were rejected in the state's primary in April. 37,000 were rejected in Pennsylvania, and Trump won by just over 44,000 votes. So, I mean, the fact is, every vote really matters.
Absolutely. Every vote really matters. And the big concern is that the number of rejected mail ballots could actually make the difference in a number of key swing states if it's close. And that's going to hurt some voters more than others, because far more Democrats say they're going to vote by mail than Republicans, right, both because they take the threat of COVID more seriously to begin with, but also because President Trump has been waging a war against mail voting, even though he himself and virtually every member of his inner circle have voted by mail or plan to vote by mail. So many more Republicans are going to vote in person. Many more Democrats are going to vote by mail. That means if we see these very large rejection rates for mail voting, that's going to uniquely disenfranchise Democratic voters. So I think it's really, really important for Democrats to understand, for all voters to understand, but particularly Democrats, since they're disproportionately using mail voting, if you decide to vote by mail, make sure you do it early. Drop off your ballot if possible, and consider voting early in person otherwise, because 40 states have early voting. And I'm convinced that in most of those states, there won't be long lines during the early voting periods. And the fact is, mail voting is a great option in a pandemic, but it's more complicated than early voting in person. More things can go wrong with mail voting. You might not get a ballot you requested. Your ballot might not arrive in time. It might be thrown out. There's more certainty if you vote in person. So I'm not telling people they should vote one way or the other. I just know from my experience, if I was concerned about having my ballot counted, I would try to go vote early in person, social distance, and have the certainty that the vote that I cast is actually counted.
Right. So that is the best bet if you can and if you feel safe doing it, to vote early. To your point, Ari, perhaps half of the votes cast in November, as many as 60 million ballots, will be requested. And CBS just came out with some numbers. In-person Election Day voting, 22% of Democrats say they plan to do that. 55% of Republicans say they plan to vote in person. When you look at mail, by mail, only 14% of Republicans say they plan to do this, 50% of Democrats. And Ari, we still don't know what's going to happen with COVID in the coming months. So if things get worse, we might have even more people voting by mail.
We could have more people voting by mail. My feeling is the mail numbers among Democrats are going to go down. And more Democrats are going to decide to vote early in person because they're concerned about mail ballots not being counted, particularly because of what's happening at the post office. That, as I said, there's just a lot more things that can go wrong with mail voting. Mail voting is not complicated if you follow all of the steps, but you have to, in many states, you have to request a mail ballot. There are some states like California, which are affirmatively sending people ballots. And I think that's really great, and every state should be doing that. However, only about 7 states are doing that. In most states, you're actually going to have to request a mail ballot. So first off, you have to figure out how to request it. Secondly, you have to get your ballot. Then you have to fill it out correctly. Then you have to send it back and hope that it arrives in time and that post office delays don't derail it. And for that reason, I'm urging people to vote by mail if they feel comfortable doing so. But I also just want to remind people that there are safe options for voting in person. I think one of the things states learned from the primaries is that we need to have enough polling places. And so states are really trying to make an effort to both do mail voting well, but also to make sure we have enough polling places. One really critical need there is, however, is for more poll workers,
right,
because a majority of poll workers are over 60. So they're in a high-risk category. And so people need to, if you're young, if you're healthy, if you feel comfortable doing it, consider signing up as a poll worker, because we need a lot of new people to become poll workers this year.
Yes, and you can just type in become a poll worker, and I just quickly got it for the Department of Elections in San Francisco, and you can find information about that. Okay, so let's go back to why so many of these ballots were rejected in the primaries, 550,000. We talked about signatures. What can people do to make sure that the signature they put on their ballot is similar or exactly the same to the one they used when they requested that ballot?
That's a good question. In some states, you can actually check what your signature looks like when you register to vote. I would say that just in general, if you sign your ballot clearly, your signature probably won't be rejected. But one really important thing is that in a number of states, election officials are able to contact voters to be able to tell them that there might be a problem with their ballot. And I think that feature is going to be very important in November, because I think a lot of people are going to be unfamiliar with the rules, particularly of mail voting, and they might make little mistakes. And I think rather than election officials throwing out all of those ballots, it would be great if election officials were able to contact voters when those ballots are received and tell them, hey, there might be a problem with your signature or something else, and therefore you have a week or so to fix it. Now, personally, I don't think we should be throwing out these ballots at all for mismatched signatures, because I think election officials are not really experts in forensic handwriting. but nonetheless, a lot of states have these laws. And so I think giving voters time to fix it is one way to try to mitigate this problem.
How do you see that playing out, though, Ari? Because just 2 days ago, a judge in Texas ordered that voters must be notified, as you said, of any issues with their signature. But what if this happens to tens of thousands of people? How do you see this playing out?
Well, election officials are going to have to try to notify tens of thousands of voters. And again, I think this is just another reason why if you're going to vote by mail, do it early and be very careful in terms of how you do it, or go vote in person, because it's very unlikely that if you vote in person during early voting, that your ballot is not going to be rejected for a quote unquote mismatched signature. And so I think this is just in the same way that we're having to take other precautions, Rose, we're having to do things that we've never done before. It's somewhat the same way with voting, right? You just have to look at this election a little bit differently than you've looked at any other past election. And both voters and election officials themselves have to make more of an effort to make sure their votes are counted. Otherwise, that's how people slip through the cracks.
Exactly. That's just the reality. That's the state that we're in. Ari, who does make these decisions and say, oh, that signature just doesn't look like the one that they used when they registered?
It's local election officials that are making that decision. But it's often the Secretary of State that is giving guidance on that. And it's often the state legislatures that are making those laws in the first place. And so one thing that I would urge people to do is get in touch with your local Board of Elections, get in touch with the Secretary of State's office, and find out what the law says in your given county or in your given state. Because, I mean, so much attention has been focused on Trump and the things he's doing, but Trump doesn't run the election. States run the elections, and even more so than that, counties run the elections, and often it's even more local than that. Your local voting precinct runs the election. And so elections are run locally, which sometimes makes them very chaotic, but also sometimes makes it easier to solve problems if you can deal with things at a local level. So I think we need to spend a lot more attention focusing on what's happening in the states, and a lot less attention focusing on what Trump is saying about voting and all the lies that he's spreading. Hmm.
Today we're speaking with Ari Berman, senior reporter with Mother Jones and author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. If you have any questions for Ari about voting, mail-in voting, we'll also talk about what we can expect on election night. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet at yourcallradio. Let's hear from Jonathan in San Francisco. Hi, Jonathan. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering if Ari could just run through some of the battleground states like Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Florida, and talk about the state of voter suppression in those states and which ones is, you know, worry him the most.
Great question. Thank you. Ari?
So there's a lot. Yeah, Rose, there's a lot going on. In Florida, actually, just a few minutes before we got on, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals just upheld a law saying that people with past felony convictions have to pay off all fines, fees, and restitution to be able to vote. So that could be a really big issue there because in 2018 in Florida, they passed a ballot initiative that was supposed to restore voting rights to people with past felony convictions. But then the GOP legislature added this requirement that you have to pay back all your fines and fees and restitution before voting, which could disenfranchise hundreds of thousands of people. So Florida is a major battleground now in terms of voter suppression. In Wisconsin, they have some longstanding restrictions on voting, like a voter ID law that kept a lot of people from voting in 2016. There was also just a decision by the Wisconsin Supreme Court yesterday that said that they might delay the mailing of hundreds of thousands of ballots while they decide whether a Green Party candidate can be put on the ballot. So there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty there. In Michigan, there are major fights right now. Michigan is one of those states where your ballot has to arrive by Election Day. And not only that, but officials can't actually start counting ballots until Election Day. And the Secretary of State wants to change that requirement so that they can start counting ballots earlier and then get results earlier. But the Republican legislature there is refusing to change that law. Same thing with Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania has the same requirement. Republicans are not allowing election officials to count votes earlier. Therefore, it could take a while for votes to be counted. There's also litigation in Pennsylvania, for example, to try to prevent voters from being able to use drop boxes to drop their ballot off. So pretty much in every major swing state, there is major litigation now over what their rules of the election are. And some of this stuff is still undecided 50-something days before the election.
Mm. Can you give us an update on drop boxes?
Yeah, I mean, it really varies state by state. In some states, I think a lot of states are expanding the use of drop boxes, but it really depends on the state. Some states are being very proactive about it. Some states are not being as proactive about it. For example, there's a law in Ohio that says that there can only be one drop box per county. So that's extremely inconvenient for people if they want to be able to drop their ballots off. In other states, like in Colorado, there's going to be hundreds of drop boxes all over the state. And in fact, in Colorado, which is a state that's done largely mail elections, 75% of the people that vote by mail in Colorado drop their ballot off. And that's one reason why Colorado has very low rates of rejection, because dropping your ballot off is more convenient and also leaves less room for error than waiting for the post office to deliver it. And so I think a number of states are expanding the use of drop boxes, but this is also one of the things the Trump administration is challenging. Trump campaign is challenging, trying to prevent states like Pennsylvania from using drop boxes, which I think is really crazy because they're basically saying you shouldn't vote by mail. But at the same time, drop boxes are what makes voting by mail safe. And yet they're trying to prevent that as well.
Hmm. And as you've been pointing out on Twitter, Mitch McConnell has been blocking $25 billion in funding for the USPS for now 119 days.
Yeah, Mitch McConnell has been blocking $25 billion in much-needed funding for the post office. He has been blocking $3.6 billion in funding for states that was passed by the House in May to help them run smooth elections. So, I mean, it's quite frankly astonishing to me that Mitch McConnell is not going to give more money to the Postal Service and is not going to give more money to help states run elections during a presidential election in a pandemic. That among all the things that Republicans are blocking, all the aid for people that Republicans are blocking, these are two really important things that McConnell and Republicans are not agreeing to. And I think it's really going to both hamstring the Postal Service and also hamstring states' ability to run smooth elections. If states don't have the money they need, they're going to have to start cutting back on stuff, either cutting back on mail voting or cutting back on in-person voting, because a lot of states don't have the money to do both well right now, given the pandemic that we're facing.
We have a number of questions from people who have signed up to vote by mail, and they say, if I want to vote in person, do I need to change my status? Do I have to bring my ballot with me?
No. My understanding is that if you sign up for a mail ballot, you can just go to the polls. I mean, the laws vary state by state, so I don't want to say anything that might be contradicted in a different state. But my understanding is you can still show up at the polls, and you can either tell them that I requested a mail ballot, but I want to vote in person, or you can just vote in person. Because, I mean, a mail ballot is just a way to vote. It's not a binding contract, you know? It's not a condition of servitude. It's just one way of voting. And so I would say that if people change their minds and they don't want to vote by mail, they can always vote in person.
Okay. So any other tips here, Ari? I mean, it does sound like if you feel safe, try to vote in early in person. That is the best way to guarantee that your vote will be counted. I mean, we're in California, and of course, it's very important. We've got, gosh, 12 state props and even more at the city level. So there's a lot of important things we're voting on. But if you lived in a swing state, for sure, it sounds like you should try to vote early and in person.
Yeah, I would say so, or vote by mail early and send your ballot back early or drop it off. I think in that case, you'll be fine if you vote by mail. I'm not so worried about the Western states that have done a lot of mail voting in the past. I mean, California already had a lot of mail voting, so I'm not that concerned about California's ability to scale it up. What I am concerned about, for example, is this is going to be the first general election in which people have voted by mail in Pennsylvania in large numbers. Same with Michigan, same with Wisconsin, that the primaries were the only test run here. And the primaries were very bumpy in these states, that there were issues with voting in person. There were also issues with voting by mail. So I think if you live in a swing state in particular, you really have to be proactive about how you're going to vote. And the earlier you start the process, the more beneficial it is both to yourself, but the more you can, quote unquote, flatten the curve for election officials so that they're not just bombarded with people showing up at the polls at the last minute or last minute mail ballot requests they might not be able to fulfill.
Ari, what are you hearing from election officials and politicians in these swing states where we saw major problems during the primaries? What are they doing to make sure we don't have those primaries, those problems in 52 days?
I think election officials are trying to do the best they can. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to staff up to make sure that they have enough people to be able to handle the big increase in mail voting. And they're also trying to make sure they have enough poll workers to be able to handle in-person voting, because they know that a lot of people are still going to vote in person. What's making their job difficult is the president of the United States lying about voter fraud every single day, telling his supporters to illegally vote twice, undermining confidence in the election. Every time I talk to election officials and I ask them, what's the biggest problem you're facing? They often will give me nuts and bolts answers, but almost always they'll say disinformation coming from the president. And so it's just really, really difficult for them to do their jobs when they're already stressed out. And then Trump goes on Twitter every day and makes up some new lie about voting. I just hope that people don't pay attention to what the president's saying. Clearly, tens of millions of people do. But I think everything he's telling you about voting is wrong. And so election officials are having to both do all of their jobs, which is trying to run mail elections, trying to run in-person elections, but they're also having to spend a lot of time educating voters about what the laws are in their states. And oftentimes that education is directly contradicting the president. And it's difficult for them to break through sometimes.
You know, Ari, every time we talk about this, I think about what happened in the year 2000 with the hanging chads in Florida. And you just have to wonder, it's been 20 years. Why are we still in this election mess in this country?
We've never, Rose, taken the steps we needed to take after the 2000 election in Florida to really upgrade our voting system. Some states have passed a lot of really good laws. I mean, look at California. California is a state in which it's very easy to vote by mail, and it's also very easy to vote in person because California is mailing ballots to all registered voters. It also has things like Election Day registration and automatic voter registration that makes it very easy to vote if you want to register and then vote in person. But a lot of states have not taken those steps, and voting has become weaponized even before the pandemic, and then it's become weaponized even more as a result of the pandemic. And so the mere act of voting is now such a contested issue. And that's especially true today. And that's why our voting system is even more insecure right now than it was in the run up to 2000. And I'm definitely afraid of a Florida 2000-like situation, not just in Florida, but in a number of other swing states if the election is close.
All right. So let's talk about that. Let's wrap up the show by talking about election night, Ari, because there is a very strong likelihood. Who knows, though, because the polls got it wrong last time. So it's so hard to know where we are right now. But if Trump has more votes on election night because the ballots have not been counted yet, and then in 4 or 5 days, all of a sudden, Biden becomes the actual winner because those votes have been counted, How are we going to deal with this? The media really need to start talking about this right now. You are. So what are your thoughts?
I think the first thing to know, Rose, there's nothing wrong with that situation. That is democracy working. There is no quote unquote election night anymore. We're going to have election week. We might have election weeks. That's just the new reality we're in because of the pandemic. It's going to take longer to count mail ballots. There's going to be more of them than in years past. And so it could take a little longer. And if the results change in a few days, that's not evidence of the system being corrupted. That's evidence of people's votes being counted and the system working. We just have to repeat that over and over and over again, because Trump is going to try to weaponize this situation. That is one reason why he's telling his supporters to vote in person. That is one reason why Republicans in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan are refusing to allow election officials to count ballots earlier, because they want this uncertainty. They want to weaponize this uncertainty to their advantage. But what we need to do is we need to trust the process, and we need to let election officials do their jobs. And all of the major institutions in society need to educate voters that this is just how the system is going to work this time. We're most likely not going to have a winner of the election at 11 p.m. on election night. And if we call a winner early, we're going to disenfranchise millions of people whose ballots are going to be counted after that. So let's just all prepare ourselves now that it might take a little bit longer. And American democracy will be better, not worse, if we give people more time to have their votes counted.
And just quickly, Ari, you were on MSNBC talking about this. Do you think that the cable shows are going to be responsible and report on it like you just laid out?
I hope so. I mean, the thing that I'm really concerned about is that it seems like so many discussions about voting now start with what the president is saying. Mm. And then it's incumbent on us to fact check it, as opposed to the other way around. And so if Trump is always our starting point, then we're always starting with a lie and having to go back to the truth. And I don't like that frame. So what I want the media to do is start with the truth and then fact check the lie, but don't always make the lie the thing that leads. And so Trump is just going to spread even more disinformation in the next 50 days and after. I think in terms of thinking about how the media is going to cover it, the media needs to cover the real issues, the real threats to voting, and not the imagined ones that are coming from the president.
Well, Ari, we are going to have you back several times in the next couple of weeks. Thank you so much for your reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rose. Great to talk to you again.
You too. Ari Berman is senior reporter with Mother Jones and author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. We will definitely stay on this a very important issue. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.